All right, we're underway with the recorder. All right, we're going to pick it up on page 566, chapter 40, verse 17 is our text. We'll pick it up in verse 17. So let's go through a little bit of a review. You know, after all, it's been 2 weeks, right? All 2 weeks, all that stuff is fuzzy in the background. Well, as we got into this chapter, we saw that Ezekiel was transported to Jerusalem. Here's Jerusalem on the west. Babylonia is in the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley here to the east. The city of Babylon located approximately there. And Ezekiel living in Tel Aviv, somewhere on the Chebar Canal, somewhere in this area to the south of the city of Babylon. And he is transported in a vision to Jerusalem. The plane sets down on Millennial Mount Zion, right in front of the Millennial Temple. And again, we'll talk about Millennial Mount Zion when we get there. This will be this is mentioned in Isaiah 2 and Micah 4, the mountain of the house of the Lord, or Millennial Mount Zion, is described as the chief of the mountains and raised above the hills. And that language tells us that this mountain will be the most important geographical location on earth and the highest geographical location on earth. And I reminded you that we're not looking at Mount Everest here. We're not looking at something 30,000 feet up in the air, because we're looking at a biblical mountain, and a biblical mountain can be quite a bit smaller. Okay, this is Mount Tabor, Har Tabor, and it is only 1,200 feet high. So our biblical Mount Zion does not have to be above the Himalayas to qualify to be the highest mountain on earth. And that's because we know there'll be vast geographical and geological changes on planet earth as it is ripped apart during the tribulation judgments. And the mountains will come down, the Himalayas will come down, just as they were once pushed up. They will now come down, and the Millennial Mount Zion will be pushed up by seismic forces to be the highest mountain on earth. And how high it will be, we don't know. But it doesn't have to be, again, 30,000 feet up. So here's an illustration of Millennial Mount Zion. We have Jerusalem, Millennial Jerusalem, off in the background there. Notice it is the highest hill. It's above the other hills. And most important, because all the nations are streaming into it to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. So that's an idea. One artist's rendition of Millennial Mount Zion, Millennial Jerusalem, and the Messianic Kingdom. All right. Now, as Ezekiel looks to the south, he sees a cityscape to the south. That will be the outline of the city of Jerusalem. And we'll talk about that when we get to the proper chapter. So right now, Ezekiel begins at the eastern gate of the temple. And he went through that temple, through that gate, and described it in detail too for us. Right there, that eastern gate. Let's see. Here is that diagram I handed out to you last week. We looked at the dimensions of the outer threshold. Then the angel moved down the corridor to the inner threshold. He also measured the alcoves, the guard rooms, six of them, three on each side of the gateway. The porch to the west was measured. He noted the small dividing walls that were in the corridor in front of all the guard rooms or alcoves. Even the windows were measured, and we looked at them. So that was the beginning of our tour of the temple. And you might ask, now why in the world does God go through all these details and even tell us about the dimensions of the windows? I mean, who cares? You know, why is that important? Well, we don't know why all this is important. We just know that Ezekiel was told, this is very important, pay attention to it. Visually, listen to what I say, look at what I measure, pay close attention so you can share this with Israel. So this is important from God's perspective. And I think one reason why it's important is that it really drives home the fact that this temple will be literal, a literal temple with literal windows and borders and all that. just as the tabernacle was literal, right? We don't have any problem with a literal tabernacle. We don't have any problem with a literal Solomonic temple. We don't have any problem with a literal temple rebuilt by Zerubbabel and remodeled by Herod. We go walk on the Temple Mount even today. We don't have any problem with a literal tribulation temple, do we? Why do people then switch to allegory when it comes to the millennial temple? I think all that we're going through is highlighting the fact that this temple is also literal. Literal. It's not just something dreamed up by Ezekiel, and that will not really exist. This temple will truly exist. Okay, any comments on that? We're going to continue in this vein throughout this chapter, measuring parts of this temple. And again, the emphasis, I believe, is on the reality of it. Jim.
I have a general question, and that is, if you and I were to look at publications or what's out there in general that have adopted an allegory in this set of chapters in Ezekiel, how do they handle all of these?
They have fertile imaginations. Okay, that's what I'm going to say, okay? Fertile imagination. In fact, there's one area that I haven't looked into that I really, when we get to it, I'll mention it. I'm going to try and find out what these guys say about a particular detail of the temple. But yeah, normally it's just, they say this is a picture of the church and its influence in the world, how big and impressive it is and things like that. You know, things like that. Very kind of vague and melodramatic descriptions of what all this is. Yeah, they make it all allegorical, a type. But we're looking at it here from a literal perspective.
Concrete.
Concrete, yes, and just as concrete as the tabernacle. Okay. All righty, so there's where we are. Let's pick it up then on page 566. We're now going to look at the 30 chambers and pavement around the outer court, starting in verse 17. So is everybody there? And the general description begins in verse 17. And he brought me into the outer court, and behold, there were chambers and a pavement made for the court all around. 30 chambers faced the pavement. So as we look up on our diagram, Ezekiel is started on the outside of the eastern outer gate. He walked through this gate as it was measured. He took a look at that gate, so he comes through it now, and he gets into the inner court. And that inner court is point G on your diagram that I've given you. Now he's going to give us a look at the inside of that outer court. What does he see there? He notices two things at the bottom of page 566, point B there. He notices chambers and pavement. And he takes some special pains to mention that pavement. It's not a that he's on. It's also not a rough natural stone floor, but it's a finished pavement. And this is similar to the Solomonic Temple. Temple 7:3, we see there that all the sons of Israel, seeing a fire come down and the glory of God upon the house, bowed down on the pavement with their faces to the ground. And they worshiped and gave praise to the Lord, saying, truly he is good. Truly his loving kindness is everlasting. So again, the Solomonic Temple was built up on a small platform. Small platform was built up, leveling off the top of Mount Moriah. And that pavement was a finished, probably limestone pavement. And we can still, you can still walk on it today because archaeologists do know the dimensions of that square Solomonic platform. That platform was expanded by Herod. So you can walk on that area today. Now, the last point at the bottom of the page notes that it might be a mosaic, a decorative mosaic page. It might be why he pays attention to it, but he doesn't mention any decorations. But a typical mosaic pavement in the Middle East is described in Esther 1:6, and that's a description of the Persian palace in Susa. They had a decorative mosaic pavement there that was noted in Esther 1:6. Now, if you go with us to Israel in November, you will see this mosaic pavement. This is the floor of a rich Roman's villa in Sepphoris. Sepphoris is just a short hop, skip, and a jump from Nazareth. But this is called the Mona Lisa of Galilee. It's a gorgeous bit of a mosaic work. Yeah, I wish the lighting was a little brighter in there. When I go this year, I will have a more sensitive camera, so I hope I can get a better picture of that. But isn't that a gorgeous piece of work? Just fantastic. And those of you that have seen it, yeah, you remember. Isn't that beautiful? Yes. Yes. Yes, right.
And they took it, they dumped it all in the Kidron Valley.
Right.
I just went and picked it up, and I was part of the group that went and sifted through this dirt. And we picked up all the debris, and we took it back to the personally picked out several little 8 of an inch squares.
Little mosaic squares, huh?
That were different colors.
Yeah.
The mosaics that were just totally ruined with bulldozers.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they destroyed a lot of archaeological treasures.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Spears,
Roman
glass.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, again, a mosaic pavement is a common feature. So you may have found part of something like that. And so the Millennial Temple may have a decorative pavement. We don't know. But again, that might be the reason why he notes it. All right, page 567. So we've looked at the pavement that caught his eye. Now, point C, at the top of page 567, he mentions that there are 30 chambers upon the pavement. Now, what he's talking about are these chambers here in this diagram, 30 of them. We don't know how they were arranged. You'll see point A there, perhaps 10 on each side to the north, the east, and the south. We know the west had a little different setup than the other sides. Now, you have a diagram, an overall diagram of the temple itself on page 612. So if you turn to page 612, you will see an overall picture, not the scale, of course, of the temple. And you'll see a possible arrangement of these chambers. You'll see them on the north and the north, the west, and the south. And there's five chambers, then the gateway, five chambers, and the gateway around three sides for a total of 30. So that's a possible arrangement there on page 612. So you can refer to that if you need to. And the English Study Bible has this arrangement. They have a three here, four, a gateway, four, et cetera, and three over there. So it still comes out to be 30. We'll get to that. Don't get ahead of me now. So anyway, we don't know why these chambers are there. Their use is unknown. Ezekiel doesn't state why they're there. He just notes that they are there. So the diagrams of the temple will have different arrangements as each commentator tries to figure out to the best of his ability exactly how these things may have looked. So, again, take every diagram with a grain of salt as a possible rendition. We will see for sure when we get there, right? I'm looking forward to saying, oh, that's what those things were. Oh, all right. There's the palm trees what you told us about, okay? Things like that. I'm looking forward to that. All righty. Verse 18 now. The pavement, verse 18. The pavement, that is, the lower pavement, was by the side. So he calls this the lower pavement. So he's probably speaking about the outer court, something like that, something in this area. Some commentators think it's just a kind of a porch around the front of these chambers. Others feel that he's talking about the lower court pavement. But one thing we learn, though, is that this court will be lower than the inner court, and we'll be ascending as we go up to the temple. To the holy place and to the Holy of Holies, we go up step by step. So that's probably what he's talking about is that area, that lower court pavement. Now he does some measuring in verse 19. This is the angel. Then he measured the width from the front of the lower gate to the front of the exterior of the inner court, 100 cubits, and on the north. So apparently what he's measuring here is this distance between the inner and outer gates, 175 feet or 100 cubits. That apparently is the distance he's talking about. It's described in words in point 2 and 3 of your outline, but every time I read through that, I couldn't picture it, so I skipped over that. You can read it yourself. So it's apparently he's, this was a hard section to study, all of it. You know, I have just pulled my hair out for weeks now as we've been going through this, trying to figure out, okay, what is he talking about? Where's this measurement? It's really probably the most difficult section of scripture I've ever done, and yet it's, you know, in some ways very simple. Once you know what he's talking about, it's going to make a lot of sense. So this has been very difficult. Anyway, there we go. Probably distance there, 175 feet. At point C on page 568, it will be true of all three gates. It says it's both on the east and the north. We'll find those measurements true of all the gates. Point D, page 568, Ezekiel now moves to the northern gate, verse 20. As for the gate of the outer court, which faced the north, he measured its length and its width. So Ezekiel is over here approximately somewhere in the outer court, and so now he moves over to point 3 on your diagram, and he's now talking about this particular gate here, the northern outer gate. And we'll find out that it's exactly the same as the eastern gate with only one new bit of information, point C at the bottom of the page. We'll learn in verse 22 that there's 7 steps going up to this gate. Okay, page 569. Point 2 at the top of the page, the interior details of this gate, verse 21. It had 3 guard rooms on each side, and its side pillars and its porches had the same measurements as the first gate. Its length was 50 cubits, and the width was 25 cubits. So again, he states that the interior of this gate is identical to the eastern gate, to the one he originally went through and measured. Then he gives us a glance at the exterior details, verse 22. And its windows and its porches and its palm tree ornaments had the same measurements as the gate which faced toward the east. And it was reached by 7 steps, and its porch was in front of them. So again, everything's identical with the addition, point B in your outline, of 7 steps. So now we learn that ground level out here was 7 steps below this outer court. And in American terms, that would probably be about 4 feet. You know, be 7 steps is about 4 feet or so. So it wasn't a large ascent, but there is a definite ascent from ground level up to the outer court. All righty, page 570. He now does some more measuring of the outer court, verse 23. Top of page 570. The inner court had a gate opposite the gate on the north as well as the gate on the east, and he measured 100 cubits from gate to gate. So again, he's saying, you know, there's a gate on the east and a corresponding gate on the inside, a gate on the north and a corresponding gate on the inside, and he measures them, the angel measures them in verse 23. And again, it's 100 cubits, or approximately 175 feet between these gates. Now he takes a hike down to the southern gate in verse 24. Then he led me toward the south, and behold, there was a gate toward the south, and he measured its side pillars and its porticos according to these same measurements. So now Ezekiel goes from the northern gate all the way around the outer court down here to the southern gate, and we're now looking at this gate. And he says that it was identical as far as measurements, identical to the other 3. He focuses on the width in verse 25. The gate and its porches had windows all around, like those other windows. The length was 50 cubits, the width 25 cubits. So again, repeated, this is an identical gate to the other two. Doesn't this strike you that he's trying to pound home the idea that this is literal? It does to me, yes.
Why was it so important to have everything symmetrical?
I don't know why it's important, but we do see that everything is very symmetrical here, yes. Everything is, in fact, you'll see it's even more symmetrical than what we've looked at. But there's no explanation as to why, other than God is a God of order. And well, I can say that beauty is very much part of God's plans. Okay, he has decorations. The tabernacle, for example, was beautiful, etc. Gold in the Solomonic temple, things like that. So we can surmise that beauty may be part of this. Architectural beauty may be part of it. But the text doesn't say. So that's the best we can do.
It's modeled after the heavenly temple.
Again, yes, the tabernacle and the all the temples are modeled after the heavenly temple. So there is a correspondence there.
Yeah, you would have to have some congruence in regards to whatever was in heaven.
Yeah.
You would model on earth. And so it's archetypically correct.
And yeah. Yeah, archetypically correct. It's very orderly and proper.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's the best we can say because there are no definite paragraphs that say, I designed this in this symmetrical way because, you know. So we have to be a little satisfied, and we'll talk to the Messiah when we see him, you know.
You know. Say it's heavenly.
It will say it's heavenly. Thank you, Roger. Okay, there we go. The man with the answers. I appreciate that. Okay. All right. Yeah, that's the best we can do. That's why I want you guys to meditate on this. You know, question. Don't go forward and giving speculation credence because, you know, we're only human beings and we can very well be wrong.
Any blood sacrifice?
We'll get to that, yes. Yeah. But, ponder this. Why in the world, Lord, did you do that? Why is this so important? It's a good thing to ponder until we see it in reality, okay? But again, don't let your imagination run away with you. Yes. Preciseness, okay.
In the Old Testament, he wanted his rules precisely. Exactly. Moses has to hit the more than, you know, Everything has to be precise.
Right. Yes, good. Another good point. Yes, obedience. Obedience is part of God's will as well, and we're to be not sloppy in our obedience. And so, the precision of this temple could highlight that as well. Sure. Okay, good thoughts, you guys. And again, remember, this is not coming out of the text, so just keep it in mind. Keep it in mind. Don't baptize it, okay? All righty. Okay, page 571. Let's see, verse 26. We now look at the steps and the arches, it says in your notes, or porches, as the NASB renders the term there. Verse 26. There were seven steps going up to it, and its porches were in front of them, and it had palm tree ornaments on its side pillars, one on each side. So again, the gate is identical to the other gates, and there we get a glance at the decorations that were on the gate, these palm trees. And again, that confirmation that we are about 4.5 feet above ground level here as we go up into this, up through this gate. All right, now again he measures between the gates in verse 27. The inner court had a gate toward the south, and he measured from gate to gate toward the south 100 cubits. So again, we're looking at these corresponding gates, the inner court and the outer court gate. He measures 100 cubits. Again, about 175 feet. So again, great symmetry, as you said, precision. Perhaps a balance and beauty are part of this as well. So good, all good thoughts. But we'll have to ask the Lord when we get there. All righty, verse 27. Now let's move on to the next page, page 572. As you can see, I'm not spending a lot of time on this because the key word you should write down is identical. That's your key word. Everything is identical, identical, identical. Great stress on that. All right, page 572. We now trek into the inner court, starting in verse 28. Then he brought me to the inner court by the south gate, and he measured the south gate according to those same measurements. So here's Ezekiel. He's by the south gate. He moved to the in front of the southern inner gate and had the angel measure the distance there. And now he actually moves through that gate to the inner court. And again, he tells us that everything was identical. Now, one point you'll notice on your outline, point A1, there is no mention of an inner wall, but these gates require it. And so, yes, there's implied that some kind of a wall separates the inner court from the outer court because you need these gates to go through the wall. So there's an implication of a barrier there necessitating the gates. Okay, so the design is the same as the outer gate. Everything is identical. Now, at the bottom of your page, page 572, point A and B at the very bottom, he talks about these porches in verse 28. Yeah, it's the same verse. Okay, well, we will learn that the porch of the outer court, and when he talks about, well, there's the gate we're looking at, when he talks about the outer porch, he's probably talking about a porch associated with these chambers that's facing inward. And then he's going to talk about an inner porch. And again, it's apparently associated with these chambers. And again, it's facing outward. So that can be confusing when it comes to a verbal description. But that's probably what he's talking about when we talk about inner and outer porches. All righty. Page 573. We're looking at this southern gate, and now we look at the inner details of the southern gate, verse 29. Its guardrooms also, its side pillars and its porches were according to the same measurements, and the gate and its porches had windows all around, and it was 50 cubits long and 25 cubits wide. So again, there's your key word is identical. It's identical to the outer gates. This, the inner gate, is identical to all three outer gates on the inside. Then he talks about the arches, point three on your outline, or porches, as it is mentioned, as it is rendered in the NASB, verse 30. There were porches all around, 25 cubits long and 5 cubits wide. Now, what exactly these are, commentators are a little bit, debate a bit about them. So notice point 3a, these porches were built either against or into the walls of the inner court. We're not quite sure exactly what they were, but they had something to do with the walls of the inner court. Then in verse 31, well, look what time it is. I've got 7:45. Let's see, verse 31, anything? Let's take a break right now. We'll pick it up at the bottom of page 573 and verse 31 as we look at the outer details of our inner gate. So listen for the shofar and come back after the break. All right, we're underway. Now, Jim shared some thoughts with me during the break as to regarding why this temple might be symmetrical and all that. He said that a circuit board, a hybrid circuit, if made properly, actually becomes, even though it has very functional, when viewed at a distance, is very eye appealing. And if you put a bunch of them together, you would have kind of a work of art that would be very appealing to you. And give me that sentence. The quality of the circuit board.
Quality of the design
reflects
on the artistic appeal to the eye, and the design reflects precision of the function.
Okay, yeah, the artistic design reflects the quality of the product there, right? And then and that's reflected in its in our visual and the visual appeal that we have, right? Yeah.
If it's designed right, it
looks good. Okay, so that might be another way to look at this temple.
Form follows
function, yeah. So we have a number of ways we can look at this temple and why it's so symmetrical and designed the way it is.
Wow.
So I thought that was a good.
Gloria,
what was your summary statement, Gloria?
I just said there's already a temple in heaven.
Right.
And it worked just fine.
There's already a temple in heaven.
Improvement can you make?
Yeah, you can't improve on it, right, yeah. And it does reflect the heavenly temple. The same model. Right, yeah. Can't improve on it. All righty. Well, we're picking it up on the bottom of page 573, and we're looking at the outer details of this southern inner gate, verse 31. Verse 31, its porches were toward the outer court, and palm tree ornaments were on its side pillars, and its stairway had 8 steps. So again, we look at the decorations that decorated the outside of this gate. And then on page 574, we get some new information. This gate varies from the other gates in one small detail, and that the outer gates had 7 steps going up to them, and the inner gates then have 8 steps. So the ascent is just a little bit higher, maybe 4.5 feet.
7 is a number of God.
7 is a number of completeness, yeah. It's considered
it?
A perfect number, yeah.
What is 8?
8, I'd have to go look up what that is.
I believe it's perfect.
Okay, yeah, that could be, yeah. The Encyclopedia Judaica has some articles on the meanings of numbers. Anyway, we have a little bit higher ascent here. We had a 4-foot ascent up to the outer court. Now we get a 4.5-foot ascent up to the inner court. So now we're 8.5 feet above ground level, and the ascent has gained a little bit higher. Now we look at the eastern gate in verse 32, chapter 40, verse 32. And he brought me into the inner court toward the east, and he measured the gate according to these same measurements. So here is Ezekiel on this location. He moves over now in front of the inner eastern gate, and again, it's identical to the other gates. Verse 33, its guard rooms, also its side pillars and its porches were according to those same measurements, and the gate and its porches and windows all around. It was 50 cubits long and 25 cubits wide. So again, the same identical construction. So write that word down, identical to the others. Page 575, the inner details of this gate, this inner eastern gate, verse 34. Its porches were toward the outer court, and palm tree ornaments were on its side pillars on each side, and its stairway had 8 steps. So again, identical with the southern gate. Now he moves us to the northern gate, verse 35. Then he brought me to the north gate, and he measured it according to those same measurements. So again, here we go as we go through the temple. Ezekiel is pausing here at this gate. He just moves over to this location, and now we're looking at the northern gate. And again, it is identical. The measurements are identical. Verse 36, the inner details. With its guard rooms, its side pillars, its porches, and the gate had windows all around. The length, 50 cubits, the width, 25 cubits. Again, all the same. The outer details, verse 37. Its side pillars were toward the outer court, and palm tree ornaments were on its side pillars on each side, and its stairway had 8 steps. Again, all identical. But now we come to some new information as we get to this northern gate. Point D in the middle of page 576. We take a look at some chambers, and we take a look at some tables that are associated with sacrifices, the millennial sacrificial system. So we begin by looking at the chamber in verse 38. A chamber with its doorway was by the side pillars at the gates. There they rinse the burnt offerings. Now, point A1 on your outline. Ezekiel is going to deal with the cells and arrangements for the sacrificial worship by and in the inner court. Now, notice point 2. It's possible that the equipment he talks about here is found at each one of the gates. But the emphasis is on the northern gate because he's standing there. Point B, he states that they washed the burnt offering there. Again, probably by the northern gate. And the reasons why we think this is probably limited to the northern gate, although it's not, we can't be dogmatic about that. The reasons, point 2A, is the context, because that's where Ezekiel's standing. But the second reason is the parallel with the tabernacle and with the temples. Point B at the bottom of the page. At the tabernacle, these sacrifices were killed at the north side of the altar. We see that in Leviticus chapter 1. God says, he shall slay it, the sacrifice, on the side of the altar northward before the Lord. And Aaron's sons and the priests shall sprinkle its blood around the altar. So in the tabernacle, the north side of the tabernacle was where the sacrifices were slaughtered. And so the millennial sacrificial system may parallel the Mosaic sacrificial system in this detail. This might be a similar detail, but there's an awful lot of changes, an awful lot of differences, so it is not the same system. Page 577. He looks at the 8 slaughter tables, starting in verse 39. In the porch of the gate were 2 tables on each side, on which to slaughter the burnt offering, the sin offering, and the guilt offering. So we see a number of tables associated with this gate, with this northern gate. Apparently, the tables are located somewhere on the inside of the gate, somewhere on the inner court. These 4 tables, anyway. We have 2 tables on one side, 2 tables on the other side. And then he names 3 kinds of offerings, 3 kinds of offerings that will be slain on these tables. The animals would be laid on these tables and then their throats cut. That's the Jewish way of sacrifice. The jugular vein is cut using an extremely sharp and smooth knife. A sacrificial knife could have no nicks in the edge at all. It had to be razor sharp and have no nicks. And the effect is that of a paper cut. You know, many times you'll get a paper cut and you won't even know you had it until, you know, there's blood all over your hand and you see that little cut on your thumb. Well, that's the effect. The animals will not feel the slice as the knife cuts through the jugular vein. That's the whole idea. They won't feel any pain. And as soon as the jugular vein is cut, the blood pressure in the brain goes to 0, and so all sensation ends. So for the animal, the lights just go out. Click. No pain, no suffering. That's the end of it. Just like turning the light switch off. So I know that those of you who love animals, cats and dogs and others, probably feel a little bit uneasy with all this. I know there's animal activists out there today that probably wouldn't like this idea, but this is what will happen. There will be sacrifices of animals during the millennial kingdom.
I got a couple cats
all home. Here we go. Too bad they're non-sacrificial animals, yeah. I know, we have some rabbits and some gophers and some chickens out in the back of the church here we could put on the table too. Now, three types of offerings are mentioned there. We will get into those offerings later when we get to the proper chapter. There's a lot of information dealing with the millennial sacrificial system to come. But you see them named there, the burnt offering, the sin offering, and the trespass offering. So I know people always ask at this point, why in the world do we have to have a sacrificial system in the kingdom? I thought Jesus was the final sacrifice. Well, I will give you a multi-page handout dealing with all that. I think a good explanation of it. But let me just give you kind of a quick overview. First of all, we have to remember that the Mosaic system and the millennial system of sacrifice have nothing to do with salvation. They do not save the offerer, okay? Right? Everybody is saved from Adam to the last man through faith. That's the golden thread, right? By grace, you're saved through faith. That's what saves us. Placing our trust in God and in His promises. And of course, for today, we place our trust in Yeshua. He is the proper object of trust. So that's the way we're saved. But what did the Mosaic and the millennial sacrificial systems do? Well, they both teach. They teach about the awfulness of sin. They teach about the need for a substitutionary death. They talk about the fact that sin must be judged and a proper penalty has to be meted out to satisfy God. And that blood atonement is the only way to do it. The sinner has to die, but a sacrifice can die in his place. That's God's mercy. Now, the Mosaic system taught those lessons looking forward to the coming of the Messiah. The Mosaic system said, okay, look at this lamb, look at the sacrificial system. That's what the Messiah will do when he comes. The millennial system looks back. Look at these sacrifices, look at this substitutionary atonement. That's what he did. That's what he did way back in the first century. So they will teach us great spiritual truths. And they will be needed to teach these truths because there will be a measure of sin in the kingdom. Remember, those that survive the tribulation will be believers, but they will enter the kingdom with natural bodies. And they will beget children who have natural bodies. You and I will have our glorified bodies already. But the tribulation saints will enter the kingdom in their natural bodies. And even though they beget children with natural bodies, those children will also be affected by the sin nature, just as we are. These will be sinners born into the kingdom. Now, Satan and his cohorts will be in the will be bound. Satan will be in the abyss, so he won't be around to stir the pot, make things worse the way we have it today. But there will be a measure of sin in the kingdom, and Yeshua will have to reign with what? With a rod of iron, right? That rod of iron means unbreakable authority. He's going to have to exercise authority. Everybody is not going to be all that cooperative. There will be a measure of sin. For example, in Zechariah, we learn that all nations will be required to observe the Feast of Tabernacles, right? And what does God say? If Egypt or any other nation refuses to observe the Feast of Tabernacles, they will be punished with drought. Okay, why are they refusing to obey God and obey the Feast of Tabernacles? Well, that's rebellion. And there will be a punishment to come upon those nations, a form of drought. What will happen at the end of the millennial kingdom? Anyone know? The last rebellion. In the book of Revelation, we learn that there will be a final rebellion, and God will have no patience with it. Yeah, he will deal with it immediately. Well, why will that happen? Because there's a measure of sin in the millennial kingdom. Then we move into the eternal state, the eternal order. There is no sin. Okay, by the end of the book of the end of the millennial kingdom, the sin issue is finally dealt with. The great white throne judgment occurs. Satan and all sinners are cast into the lake of fire. The sin issue is dealt with. Then we enter the eternal order, and there'll be no sin. We won't have to worry about that. But there will be a measure of sin in the kingdom. And that's why this teaching tool of the sacrificial system will exist. Any problems with that? Okay? No? No? Plenty. Well, it's a great teaching tool. It's an audiovisual teaching tool, you guys. You know, we are, in 21st century America, we are so isolated from the reality of the awfulness of sin. You know, those sacrifices will really portray the awfulness of sin and the how terrible it is because it requires the death of the sinner. Now, if we were born on the farm, and some of you may have been, some of you may have slaughtered animals for your dinner. You know, you know more about this. I've never seen that. I've never participated in it. You know, my meat comes from McDonald's. It already comes between two pieces of bread, right? When I go to the store, what do I see? These nice little purified, little styrofoam plastic covered pieces of meat, you know. No blood, no smell, no struggling animal, you know. I don't go back into the butcher shop. I don't go to the slaughterhouse where these animals that we're feeding on every day get killed by the thousands, okay? We don't see that. We're insulated from that because we go to the supermarket. We don't go out in the backyard and do in that pig, you know? I hope you guys don't eat pig. Anyway, we don't do that, so we're insulated from it. But those lessons will be graphically taught to us or to the people in the Messianic Kingdom through the sacrificial system. And there won't be an insulation there. Question?
No, from time to time, you need a new butcher.
You need a new butcher from time to time. I don't know how that relates to our discussion here.
You need a different kind of meat to be happier.
All right, so anyway, I'll have a multi-page handout. Jesus is the ultimate sacrifice, the true sacrifice that all these sacrifices point to and teach us about, okay? They did not save us, but they teach us about Yeshua and what he did for us. All righty, that's a preview. And I'll give you a handout that'll go into that in detail, and you can read that when we get there. All right, so we've looked at these first four tables associated with these offerings, but there are more tables in verse 40. Verse 40. On the outer court, on the outer side, as one went up to the gateway toward the north, there were two tables, and on the other side of the porch, on the other side of the porch of the gate, there were two tables. So apparently now we go to the outside. Apparently now he goes through this northern gate, and associated with the northern gate, two on this side and two on this side, are more slaughter tables, more tables where animals will be laid and their throats cut. So apparently both sacrifices in the inner court and sacrifices in the outer court. He totals them up in verse 41, and even I can do the math, which is amazing. Four tables were on each side next to the gate, or eight tables on which they slaughter sacrifices. So again, these animals are placed on these tables. A Holocaust table.
Do they burn?
There is some of them are, one is the burnt offering, yes.
So
one,
they breed them and burn.
Yeah, there will be this burnt offering, sin offering, and trespass offering, yeah. All right, now there are four other tables that catch his eye in verse 42. Verse 42. For the burnt offering, there's your Holocaust offering. For the burnt offering, there were four tables of hewn stone, a cubit and a half long, a cubit and a half wide, and one cubit high, on which they lay the instruments with which they slaughter the burnt offering and the sacrifice. So now we see in point 3A1A, there's four tables specifically associated with the burnt offering, and they're hewn stone, they're stone tables, and they're not that big. Point B, about a yard square, 31 and a half inches approximately, about a yard square. And then point D, almost 2 feet high, 21 inches high. So just some little low tables. But these tables are important because the instruments for sacrifice are laid on these tables and within easy reach of the priest who has to do the sacrificial system, sacrificial offering. So there'd be knives, point A at the bottom, and there'd also be receptacles for catching the blood. And if you go with us to Jerusalem in November, we will go to the Temple Mount, to the Temple Institute, and you will see the Mizrach. And there's more than one of these that the Temple Institute has constructed. But these are the traditional rabbinic interpretation of the little flagons that hold the blood, that catch the blood of the sacrifice. Now they're curved on the bottom. This one needs a special stand to sit in so it can be photographed, but there's a reason for that. Now the blood is drained into the Mizrach, and of course when the throat is slit, the heart keeps pumping and it just the jugular vein, and it's caught in the Mizrach. Then the priest will take it to the altar, and they will either dash it against the side of the altar, you know, with just a quick jerk of the hand, or they will pour the blood out at the base of the altar. So that's the function of the Mizrach. And you can see the base is rounded. That's to make sure that the priest hangs onto the Mizrach. If he doesn't, it'll fall over and the blood will spill out. So he's forced to hold on to it and keep it doesn't coagulate and dry. So it's deliberately designed to make sure that it stays in motion at all times so the blood remains liquid. No, they're not very big. No, they're just a little bowl to catch the blood.
They don't look big enough to hold the blood, especially.
Well, they don't have to hold every drop.
Oh. Okay.
They just have to catch the blood of that sacrifice, and dash it on the altar. Doesn't mean that it's a great big cow. It doesn't mean it has to pump itself dry. So just the representative of the blood. Okay, so that's some of the instruments that will be found on those little tables. Page 579. Other utensils are mentioned in verse 43. Verse 43, the double hooks, one hand breadth in length, were installed in the house all around, and on the tables was the flesh of the offering. So he talks about some hooks here. These hooks would be hooks used for flaying the sacrifices. Now here's a rendition of the Herod's temple, and here you see some columns with hooks attached to them, and there is the lamb or the goat, and it's being flayed there by the priest. You can see he has his sacrificial knife, and he is preparing the corpse for the sacrifice. Here we have a little stone table, right? We have the skin of the animal on that table, but it could easily, just as easily, hold the knives or the Mizrach or whatever. So this is maybe similar to what we see in the Millennial Kingdom, these hooks for holding these sacrifices. Now my thought is, I wondered how the guys that allegorize all this stuff deal with details like the meat hooks here. I'm going to have to look this up and see how they handle that. What would be the deep spiritual meaning of a meat hook? Here we're just viewing it as a literal necessity for the sacrificial system.
Well, and it's a suspension of a sacrifice like Christ. He was suspended.
Well, maybe. Maybe. It's not exactly a crucifix at all. So that's a good speculation. You know, we can use our fertile imaginations, but it doesn't say that. It just says it's for the sacrifices.
Why would they have to have so many priests?
Oh yeah. Now here we see priests carrying the pieces of the animals up to the altar to be tossed onto the fire, or to be used for the priests. The priests did eat some parts of the sacrifice, depending what it was. So we may see something like this in the Messianic Kingdom. So he points out these hooks used for flaying the sacrifices. Now, point E, middle of page 579, our attention is now directed to the chambers for the priests. We begin in verse 44. From the outside to the inner gate were chambers for the singers in the inner court, one of which was at the side of the north gate, with its front toward the south, and one at the side of the south gate facing toward the north. So we're looking here at a couple of chambers beside the north and south gate. Now notice point C at the bottom of your outline. Point C says one at the side of the east gate. Do you see that on your outline? Your version, depending what version of the Bible you have, may render it the east gate. The Septuagint renders the word there as the south gate. The NASB renders it the south gate. And most commentators follow the Septuagint and render that phrase one at the side of the south gate. And that's exactly what this our diagram does as well. And I'll show you that in just a second. So he begins, he's noted these two chambers, and now he turns our attention to the one on the north side in verse 45. He said to me, "This is the chamber which faces toward the south, intended for the priests who keep charge of the temple." So now as we look at our temple, he's looking at this chamber here on the northern side with its opening facing south. Point F on your outline there. Now we learn that these are the chambers used by the priests who are responsible for the day-to-day operation of the temple. We'll learn that in Ezekiel 44. Point C makes the point that these are non-Zadokite priests. We'll see them distinguished from the Zadokites in just a moment. So these are members of the tribe of Levi, but they're not members of the family descended from Zadok. They're from the same tribe, but not from the same family. So now our attention is turned to the south side in verse 46. But the chamber which faces toward the north is for the priests who keep charge of the altar. These are the sons of Zadok, who from the sons of Levi come near to the Lord to minister to him. So now our attention is directed to chamber E on your diagram. Again, it's on the south side, but it faces north. The entrance is to the north. This is for the Zadokite priests. And we're told that they, point A, are the keepers in charge of the altar. So they're in charge of the actual sacrifice. We're also told that they're the sons of Zadok. So they're a segment of the tribe of Levi, point one. Now, why are they singled out? Well, they became prominent, point two, toward the bottom of the page there. They became prominent when the house of Eli was set aside for unfaithfulness. Now, Eli was the first high priest. His sons were very irresponsible, wicked priests. And Eli did not rebuke them or discipline them. And so what happens? The prophet comes to Eli in 1 Samuel 2, verses 27 through 36, and he lets him know that his family is going to be set aside. Then a man of God came to Eli and said to him, "I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who will do according to what is in my heart and in my soul. And I will build him an enduring house, and he will walk before my anointed always. Everyone who is left in your house will come and bow down to him for a piece of silver and for a loaf of bread. And he will say, 'Please assign me to one of the priest's offices so that I may eat a piece of bread.'" So you see the family of Eli here is denigrated, is brought very low in the sacrificial order of priests. Now who is this Zadok guy? Point three at the bottom of the page. Zadok was a priest during the time of David and Solomon. And this particular priest was faithful to David and Solomon. And we see this portrayed for us in 1 Kings 1:8. "Then Zadok the priest, Benaniah the son of Jehoiada, Nathan the prophet, Shimei, Rei, and the mighty men who belonged to David were not with Adonijah. One of David's sons, Adonijah, tries to take the throne, but these people stay loyal to David and Zadok the priest." Remain loyal to him. Now in 1 Kings 2:27, David's rightful successor takes the throne. And what does Solomon do? Solomon dismissed Abiathar from being priest to the Lord. And this is explained, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord which he had spoken concerning the house of Eli in Shiloh. That section of scripture that we looked at 1 Samuel 2, 27 through 36 comes to pass in 1 Kings 2, 27. The house of Eli is now dismissed from having an important role in the priesthood. And then in 2 Kings 2, 35, the king, this is Solomon, appointed Benaniah, the son of Jehoiada, over the army. That replaces his successor. And the king appointed Zadok, the faithful priest, in the place of Abiathar. So this general remained loyal to David. He becomes the commander-in-chief of the army. This priest remained loyal to David, Zadok, and so he is now elevated to the place of high priest, and his family is elevated, and they retain their distinct position even into the kingdom. So that's where it came from. This will also be mentioned at the bottom of the page in Ezekiel 43, then in page 581, Ezekiel 44 and 48. So again, this is their chamber. This is associated with the Zadokites. All right, point F, verse 47. Now he measures the inner court. He measured the court, a perfect square, 100 cubits long and 100 cubits wide, and the altar was in front of the temple. So now we get a look at this inner court, 175 feet by 175 feet, and he mentions the altar in that oval there. The altar was in the center of this inner court in front of the temple. Verse 47b, and the altar was in front of the temple. Again, you see our location right here in the center of the court, but located directly in front of the temple. All right, page 582, and we just have a couple of more verses to go through. Now we come to the temple itself in verse 48, and from verse 48 through chapter 41, we'll be in the temple. Now there is a diagram of the temple proper for you on page 600, if you want to refer to that. This will probably make it a little more a little easier to understand what's going on in these chapters. And then I've given you a supplementary diagram as well. So let's finish up verses 48 and 49, and we'll call it quits for tonight. Well, he begins by describing the posts in verse 48. And he brought me to the porch of the temple and measured each side pillar of the porch, 5 cubits on each side. So Ezekiel is somewhere near the northern gate. He now moves over in front of the temple, and he's going to be describing this building here, the temple proper. So let's get a little bit of a close-up of it. Here we are. I've just enlarged that particular section of the diagram, and we'll begin by discussing the foyer area or the entrance to the temple itself. Now he talks about the post of the porch. He's probably talking about these doorposts here. And he states that they are 8 3/4 feet wide. And then in verse 48b, he says, second part of the verse, he says, and the width of the gate was 3 cubits on each side. So it's about 5 feet deep. 8 feet wide here and about 5 feet deep is the entrance pillars for the structure. As we look at the measurements for this temple, point B, point parentheses B, we will learn that the entrance itself is 24.5 feet wide. 24.5 feet there to enter the temple. That's the opening width of the gate. Now he talks about the porch in verse 49. The length of the porch was 20 cubits and the width 11 cubits, and at the stairway by which it was ascended were columns. Let's read the whole verse. Were columns belonging to the side pillars on each side. So at the bottom of the page, we see that the porch was 20 cubits from north to south, or about 35 feet long. So there's some kind of a porch here, 35 feet long, that he's describing. And then the width of that porch is 11 cubits from east to west. some dimension in here, we're not sure, probably this dimension in here, 20 feet, about 20 feet, 19 and a quarter feet. And this is very similar to the Solomonic temple. And then we learn that there's steps going up to the temple, so we're going to ascend one more time as we go up to the temple. So we're constantly going up, ascending as we move toward the holy place. The pillars are mentioned in the second part of verse 49. He's probably talking about some decorative columns located near the porch. This diagram has them on the outside. The diagram on page 600 has them on the inside. But they're similar to the Temple of Solomon. Here again, we have the ascent up to the porch. We have the doorway, and we have these freestanding columns. In Solomon's temple, they were known as Yachin and Boaz, at the bottom of your page there. Now, this brings us then to page 584 and chapter 41. So we're going to call it quits right here, and we're going to enter into the holy place itself next week when we get to chapter 41. Alrighty, I know this has been quick. I hope these diagrams have helped it make more sense to you. Let me go ahead and pray, and then I'll let you go. I've kept you 5 minutes over. I appreciate your patience. Father, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, again, we want to thank you for your word. Again, Lord, help us to meditate upon this structure that you are going to construct in the millennial kingdom. And there's been a lot of good ideas discussed today. Beauty, symmetry, precision, obedience, the fact of quality being revealed through a fine structure, the heavenly temple. Help all these thoughts run around in our heads as we contemplate these chapters of your holy word. And help us to remember that this is important in your eyes, so we need to consider this as an important section of Scripture, not something boring or irrelevant or or meaningless, but something that is going to teach us about Yeshua, teach us about you, and teach us great spiritual truth. So again, we ask you to help us to meditate on it throughout our lives and gain from it. And we ask this in Yeshua's name. Thank you. Amen. All righty, you guys. We will see you next week.